This is Live at Politics and Prose, a program from Slate and Politics and Prose Bookstore in Washington, D.C., featuring some of today's best writers and top thinkers.
Arlie Russell Hochschild is Professor Emerita of Sociology at the University of California, Berkeley. A renowned sociologist, she is the author of 8 previous books, including 3 New York Times Notable Books of the Year. She is also the recipient of several prestigious awards and fellowships, including a Guggenheim and a Fulbright. In Strangers in Their Own Land, Professor Hochschild turns her attention to the Louisiana Bayou. Over the course of 5 years, she visited with and befriended men, women, and children in the bayou in order to, as she puts it, begin to understand how life feels to people on the right. The result is a remarkably compelling work that Joan Blades has described as providing, quote, a vital roadmap to bridging the deep divides in our political landscape and renewing the promise of American democracy, end quote. Professor Hochschild will be in conversation today with Barbara Ehrenreich, who has herself written 21 books, including the celebrated memoir Nickel and Dimed. Please join me in welcoming Professor Hochschild for what is certainly a very timely visit to Politics and Prose.
These work?
They work.
Does this work?
Huh?
Yes. Oh.
Okay. Hi, I'm Barbara, and Arlie and I are very often in conversation.
Yeah.
So this is not like a strange event for us. In fact, we're kind of continuing the conversation we were having right now, and which we'll go on to afterwards as over a drink or something. And I can't tell you how important this book is. And actually fascinating to read. But it really hit me recently when Hillary made the comment about the baskets of deplorables. Mm-hmm. I have no idea what that metaphor comes from. Do you?
No idea.
Okay. So I had actually read somewhere it was Wall Street.
Oh.
Yeah. Anyway, the whole idea of baskets that are deplorable. Yeah. And that was... I found it profoundly shocking. Mm-hmm. She said that half of Trump's supporters were in this basket of deplorables, and the others had some kind of economic grievance that they, for inexplicable reasons, were trying to express through the megaphone of Trump. Mm-hmm. I've been in these arguments now for many months because I was a Sanders supporter, and.
Me too.
Yeah, and I've been, you know, you get attacked if you criticize Hillary, and I remain critical, although I'll no doubt drag myself out to the voting booth in November. But that was a turning point for me when she said she dismissed about a quarter of the population in this way. And yet I find this, I was just talking to Arlie about this, among my liberal friends, that they basically agree that there's something really wrong with a lot of Americans. And if you disagree, if you try to say, no, let's find out what's going on with them, you're likely to be told, well, why are you defending a racist? Mm-hmm. You know, Trump, that mm-hmm. is. Mm-hmm. Which I'm not, but there's like zero discussion, and Arlie was just pointing out there's very little sociological attention to the ground troops, the Trump supporters, the Tea Party people, and so this is so important to read this, and I just want to start by saying I get a lot of credit, sometimes undeserved, I think, for being brave, for writing Nickel and Dimed, where I went into some situations that were difficult and possibly dodgy. And
you were sweeping floors and washing windows.
Yeah, I actually did something.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah, you did.
But I cannot imagine doing what you did. I'm sorry. You cannot ask me to spend years and months and weeks at a time in Louisiana in the, in this deep red state mentality. Mm-hmm. And you did it. So I want to first say, tell us a little about that. I mean, everybody knows you're a person on the left. You're a liberal. You're a feminist.
Mm-hmm.
You come from Berkeley. You know, and so
Brand.
You had to introduce, you know, so here you are with this, these people, the other in liberal discourse. What was that like?
Yeah, well, first of all, it's great to be in conversation with my old pal. You would, if you got down there, actually get into it too. I 5 years ago had a feeling that I had to understand this growing divide and a sense that there was a split that might become unbridgeable, that each side was getting more strong and fierce and well defended, and that we live in enclaves, geographic enclaves, media enclaves, electronic enclaves. And I realized that when I talk to my husband Adam, or I talk to my friends, or I talk to Barbara, everyone agrees with me. And yet I look at the paper and I turn on the television and I think, ye gods, there is something I don't understand. And so one day I just decided, you know, let me get out of my Berkeley enclave and go as far as I can into an equal and opposite enclave. Now, where would that be? The right has grown the most rapidly in the South. Okay, I wanted to go south. It's grown most rapidly among whites, especially blue-collar whites. Okay, let me talk to blue-collar whites. Older, many of them religious. Okay, all that. But where in the South? I looked in the 2012 Obama re-election stats to the proportion of whites who voted for Obama. It was half in California, half of whites voting for Obama, 2012, a third in the South, the whole region, and 16% in Louisiana. So I thought, okay, the super South, great, let me just go there. And I had in mind kind of the usual red state paradox. How is it that the poorest states, the ones with the worst schools, the worst hospitals, the worst health, the lowest life expectancy, the highest rate of pollution, who receive from the federal government more funds in aid than they give in taxes, revile the federal government? You know, I just didn't get it. And Louisiana was an exaggeration of that story, because it is, as of this year, the poorest state, beating out Mississippi. And 44% of its state budget comes from the federal government. And one study found half of potential voters agreed with the tenets of the Tea Party. And it just, a primary went of the Republican Party went to Trump. So it was very right wing as well. It was those three things. It was like a condensation of this paradox. So I thought, time for me to take my own alarm system off.
Could you have done
that's where we may be. That's the thing. Just take it off. Not forever, and it's not hard to do. And go and just find out, try and cross this empathy wall, is how I came to think of it, to see if I could get into the emotional experience of the right wing. So I'm putting emotions into the story. I'm tracking feelings, not to crowd thinking out, but in fact to get at the basis of a kind of thinking. And I'll give you an example of one encounter that indicated why, in fact, this wasn't so brave or so hard, and was actually fun. I know, sounds strange, but there were very fine people, very complex people, very ambivalent people ending up in the opposite court, but reaching out back to me. I was at a meeting of the Republican women of Southwest Louisiana, and a big luncheon table, very well organized, by the way, you know, 80 people, and they meet once a month, and they have plans and outreach, and there was a special table for teens, and they said, oh, the Democrats don't have anything like this. Very proud. And there was a gun raffle, and, you know, there was you know, prayer and salute with God in it to begin. So I'm sitting around this table, and someone is across the way, and very beautiful woman, lovely voice, and she said, I love Rush Limbaugh. So I took a little second there and said, you know, I'd really love to talk to you about that, and can we meet for sweet teas tomorrow? And she said, sure. She turned out to be an amazing gospel singer. Her husband was a Pentecostal minister of an enormous megachurch. She later invited me to the church. I went many times, and I could speak to anybody in the congregation. Became a really an amazing way of getting to know people. Anyway, we met. And so back to Rush Limbaugh. What was the appeal? Well, I love Rush because, and he's my, what you call him, my deep heart, brave heart, because he hates feminazis. So I took another little swallow. And feminazi, well, what is a feminazi? Can you explain? Well, it's these feminists. They're hard, they're tough, they're mean, they're self-centered, they're career-oriented, they don't think anything about families. And so she went on to that and then talked about environmental wackos and them. And then she circled back. You know, when I was talking about feminazis, she said, how did that make you feel? Was that hard for you to hear what I said? Suddenly I felt seen. And I said, actually, no, it isn't hard, because I'm not here to convince anybody, but to learn, to really try and get into seeing the world the way you do, if you'll let me. And she said, I do that too. I know about doing what you're doing. I can take my alarm system off too. So we had that in common at first, very unexpected to me. And then she said, you know really why I love Rush Limbaugh? It's because he defends me against all the liberals out there in the wider world that think I am Southern and backward and stupid, and all the epithets that I'm homophobic, that I am sexist, that I am racist, and that I'm fat. She was... substantial, but she felt Michelle Obama was telling her, you know, big government wagging its moral finger, that she should just have apples and carrots. So I heard that. That became a refrain of we are criticized. We are looked down on. We are, you know, in so many words, deplorables. And that he seemed to defend her from that. Well, I learned a ton, and I was thrilled. And later, you know, we met many times over 5 years, and she said, well, you're my first Democratic friend. So over the 5 years, I did interview 60 people, 40 of whom were deeply right-wing, Tea Party. Although all of that has morphed into Trump in a very strange way. And and that paradox that I started with, the red state paradox, I came to understand that they know about that paradox. That's not news to them, but it sinks in importance. It's not the main thing for them. And so something else became the main story. And I might tell it through a character. Okay. One person who begins the book was a man I met who was born on a plantation. And I asked him, can you take me to where you were born, where you went to school, and where your parents were buried? And can I just, yeah, sure. So he took a day off of work, and he got me in his black truck, and we were driving through a sugar plantation in outside Donaldsonville, what's the then called the Armalee's Plantation. It's on the lower loop of the Mississippi River, now called Cancer Alley, because it's got petrochemical plants on each side that, in essence, replace the old plantations. Big piece of this story, it turns out. Anyway, we're driving through this plantation, and he's got his arm out the window. Well, now, my Uncle Pook used to have his carpentry shop there, and the neighbor had there. We're just looking at sugarcane. And I realized, look, he sees this beloved bygone community that he feels big government is robbing us of. And I'm looking at green sugar cane. So I thought, okay, let me go a little closer here. He spent his childhood in the Old South, the sugar plantation South, but his adult life in the New South, which is to say oil. He measured the various materials used to build these enormous white tanks that hold toxic chemicals and oil and gas. And some of the materials used to build platforms out in the Gulf of Mexico. So he said, I'm Tea Party because I just don't like big federal government, don't even like state government. It gets in the way of, it supplants the beauty of community life. Well, I thought, what would happen if such a person as he were to suffer an extraordinary environmental disaster that was caused by an oil company that had not been sufficiently regulated. And he was to lose his beloved community because of that industrial accident. What would happen? What would he think? Well, as fate would have it, precisely that occurred. Here's a man who had worked all his life. He was 63, coming on retirement. And in his first job, he got no vacation, 1 week sick time and vacation together. He loves to fish. He loves to fish. He just can't get the time to go out to it. In the second 5 years at this place of work, he got 2 weeks. He said, I haven't had a month's vacation since I was in college, all those years ago. So he loved nature. He could tell you what the face of 10 kinds of fish looked like. he kind of illustrated these fish faces because they were his friends almost. He knew nature intimately and bird calls, but couldn't get out to nature. Now he was about to retire, and just at that time, out on this bayou that he lived by, it's called Bayou Corn, and you can Google it when you go home. Bayou Corn, .. sinkhole. Because what happened was there was a Texas brine which drills very deep under the bayou to bring up this brine, very useful in fracking and in making industrial goods. Texas brine drilled down where they knew it was dangerous to drill. And they did it anyway. And what happened was it was like pulling the plug on a bathtub. The water started to go down, down, down. It pulled down 100-foot high and year old, beautiful old cypress trees just crashed down and into the sinkhole. It took a boat down with it. And it, meanwhile, toxic methane-drenched mud replaced this pristine swamp area. And so methane gas was everywhere. He was in his garage. He had a monitor because it was dangerous if you lit a match. And when it rained, the puddles would look like Alka-Seltzer. And the yards got tipped. And there had been never earthquakes before, but there were now earthquakes. It was a disaster, and the 360-person community that he so loved, community of Bayou Corn, was evacuated. Only a few people became what they called stayers. And when I first really got to talk to him, he was a stayer. The neighbors had gone, he was there. And I asked him, well, why are you staying? Isn't it kind of dangerous with the methane gas in the garage? And he said, yes, but I have my monitor and I wake up at night, I check the monitor. And I'm really here to guard the property of my neighbors, you know. And then he waited a long time and he said, actually, I don't want to leave. I love this community. I'm holding on to it. I don't want to leave. So I got to talking to him about what it would be, of why he wouldn't want firmer regulation. I mean, wasn't it actually industry that had taken his beloved community away and not big government? And this, so I was holding on to my red state paradox and looking through the keyhole of a devastated environment, because that accident was not alone. All of Louisiana is very much environmentally harmed. And here is, I didn't press him with, you know, I'm being really slow about inquiring into him. But it's always with the same question, why not? Why not? Can't there be good government? Well, here is what, in the end, I realized was an answer to why he kind of threw away the paradox I had started with and had held on to his Tea Party view. The government, I think there were three layers of his resistance to government. One was the government was the North, you know, always the North with its wagging finger. It won the war, it came down and replaced the government of Louisiana, then the carpetbaggers. Then later on, you know, the civil rights workers, of which my husband and I were ones. And then came the wagging finger of the environmentalist, you know, you're not protecting your environment. So partly it was the North let us decide things ourselves. That was one layer. But you know, I don't think it was major. There was a second thing that I did not understand the logic of until I got close up. And that is this. I'm giving this my, in a way, progressive twist. Okay, what you're going to hear is my, let's see if I make it succinct, but I think a certain logic was going on there. But I recently have just been back there and said hi to all the people I interviewed and who are in the book and did a dinner for them. So I talked to him recently and he said, yeah, you know, I think this is right. So it goes like this. The second reason that he's resistant to government is this. In Louisiana, the government has been captured by oil. That is, the state government is like a servant to the oil and petrochemical companies. And it does not protect the people. I didn't know that before, but that's clearly true. And in the book, I show you how. So what happens is that the companies really get a lot of things. And Governor Jindal, you know, two-term governor, said, please come you and expand these petrochemical companies here in Lake Charles and elsewhere in Southwest Louisiana, the buckle of America's energy belt. We will give you $1.5 billion, which they did in so-called incentive money. So you don't go to Texas, you come to Louisiana, and you've got this money. With that money, the companies now give out gifts. Oh, so let's make a donation to the Audubon Society. Isn't the company nice? And another donation to the Bird Sanctuary. Isn't the company nice? And another donation to the public schools science program. Isn't the company nice? So in a way, the company looks like it's giving people jobs, although these are highly automated companies, and they have very few jobs. 15% of all jobs in Louisiana have to do with oil, no more than that. And they import Filipina pipe fitters. So it's a modern version of global capital there that's not that advantageous. But people see, and Mike, Chef, sees the company is giving him something, giving him jobs and being generous to the community. Meanwhile, the state is holding the bag. It is doing the moral dirty work for the companies. We're not going to, you know, we're supposed to regulate you and reduce number of accidents, but the companies don't want to be regulated very much. And they become like the complaints clerks. They have to deal with a defective service. So you hate the state because it's not doing its job, and that interlocks with another personal logic. You don't want to pay those taxes because you haven't had a raise in 20 years, and you were just working, now your wife's working too. First you were working shorter hours, now you're working longer hours. You may owe a little something to the bank for a mortgage payment. What's another way of reaching the American dream? Well, getting some of that tax money. So you're not wanting to pay taxes to a defective state, and you want the taxes for your own personal use. So it's the combination of a kind of industry state arrangement and a personal desire to maximize income. And it's the linkage of those that is a second reason that Mike Schaff didn't believe in taxes for raising the salaries of these do-nothing state workers. So it was a captured state. Not every state is captured, but this one clearly was, and for him that was important. But there was yet a third, and I think more primary, reason that he resisted the federal government. I began to wonder how I could do this, how I could climb the empathy wall, how I could really get to how they felt. And I did it through what I call a deep story. What is a deep story? A deep story is a story that is reality as it really feels like. You take the moral judgment out, you take the facts out. It's just the story as it feels. And I think deep stories underlie the politics of the right. I think they underlie the politics of the left. But this is their deep story. You're part of a long line, almost like a pilgrimage, going to the top of the hill, at which is the American dream. The line is not moving, and you've been in it a long time, and you really feel like you deserve the prize at the end of this long line. And you don't hate anybody, but you know, you've waited a long time and it hasn't moved for a long time. Then you notice some line cutters. Who's that? Well, that's an affirmative action black who may be taking a job that's formerly been reserved for whites. It's an affirmative action woman who may be taking a job formerly reserved for men. and then there are immigrants, and then refugees, and then the oil-soaked brown pelican endangered in Louisiana, almost disappeared. It's, and now they're putting animals ahead of us. You know, I'm not moving in line, and all these people are ahead. Then Barack Hussein Obama, who is supposed to be impartially monitoring the line on behalf of everyone, seems to be waving in this deep story to the line cutters. In fact, he's sponsoring them. And he's in fact, isn't he one of them? Doesn't he have a single parent family? I mean, how could they afford a Columbia education, a Harvard education? I heard that all the time. You know, well, I couldn't ever get there. I mean, how did he? Something's rigged. Something's rigged. So they felt, okay, actually the federal government isn't just the instrument of the North or the instrument of oil, it's the instrument of their own marginalization. Whole federal government, they think, in this story, is an instrument of their own being pushed back. And that president isn't their president. They often would say that. They would all say that. It's somebody else's president. Maybe it's your president. And we're looking around to be represented by someone. And then at the very end in this deep story, and this is where the reprehensibles comes up, someone, deplorable. I got my epithets mixed up, turns around, that's ahead of you in line, turns around and said, those rednecks, those stupid, ignorant, regional, southern, you know, rednecks, and that's it. That's it. That it encapsulates, in a way, a kind of an honor squeeze. They cannot, they feel demographically ever more scarce. They feel as religious people. They feel they're living in a secularizing society. The whole social mores that show what a good family is. Those have changed, and they are slower to change their views. Not unchanging, but at a slower pace. They feel those liberal insults, and all of it together makes them feel like strangers in their own land. And for a guy like Mike Scheff, he even feels like the air he's breathing and the water that he would fish in is not really his water or his air. It's a real estrangement and a mourning. We see the anger, you know, on the nightly news, but we don't see, I think, what lies under it for a lot of them, a kind of a mourning. So at the end of the day, the government has been instrument of the North, instrument of oil, instrument of their self-marginalization. I went back to people and asked them, hey, is this deep story? Does it make any sense? Yeah, you've read my mind, lady. You know, yes, I live that metaphor. So that's what feels real to them. There's a lot of... in that deep story, there is embedded racial views, and there are there's economic distress, but it comes as part of this larger, I think, story of estrangement. The very end, when I had almost finished all my research, and I was just winding things up, Donald Trump came to a primary rally in New Orleans, and that's in the book too, kind of. And I felt as I'm watching this charismatic guy who's kind of really, in a way, soaking in and expressing an estrangement, and even a mourning, I would argue. His little pursed lips that I used to think, oh, that's a spoiled boy, like that. But part of it is, oh, America is so down and down, and no, we can take it. you know, and then improve it. I felt like I had spent 4.5 years studying the kindling, and that then I had botched the match. And so in the end, I had started with this red state paradox, but I end with two more paradoxes. Paradoxes being my favorite word. paradox for the right is, look, if you were originally for small government, you're not voting here for a small government guy. If he wants to scratch out every undocumented worker, he's got to set up a surveillance state that's going to cost an arm and a leg. And putting 90,000 new troops on the ground, man, you were worried about that debt. Well, that's going to go way up. That's their paradox now, and they're aware of it and weighing things, but still going for someone who is speaking, making visible, very visible, a kind of their, he is expressing a visibility they wish they had. So that's their paradox. And ours is, wait a minute, if the Democratic Party was supposed to be the party of the working man and the working woman and even those of us to the left of it, you know, speaking for those who are working in difficult jobs, why is there such a hemorrhage out of these parties? I think that's ours, and I think it's enormously important for us to take the next steps out of our paradox.
Let me interject a comment and a question, and then we'll open it up for everybody's comments and questions. This is, you know, it's all coming back, you know, reading the book and the strong feelings that it gave me as you talk. There is, you know, what you say brings absolutely true to me. And my background is in the white working class, which was once liberal democratic. That's how old I am. and, you know, to see this happen is just so painful.
Yeah.
But what I wondered, for my question to open up the questioning, is did you sometimes directly engage people on the subject of race, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, my own experience is people who are really, really right-wing racists are very insistent that they're not racist.
Yes.
And, what you know, it's just, they're not going to be using the same PC language and everything. Mm-hmm. We would. But what happened when you brought that up, that issue up all by itself?
You know, I came to realize that racism has so many different faces. It isn't all one face. And I realized that everyone said, oh, I'm not a racist. First, they avoided the subject because they, and then they confessed that they thought that I would think they were, because we were in the South, and then they would say, I'm not a racist, and then I would ask them what they thought racism was, and they would say, you're racist if you hate blacks, right? Or if you use the N-word. And I don't hate blacks, and I don't use the N-word, so I'm not a racist. But that, of course, leaves out an enormous number of expressions of racism. But I so often heard kind of feelings that were in motion. Let me give you an example. Going back to this guy, Mike Sheff, I said, well, how did race enter in, you know, to your life? And he said, well, you know, we integrated my high school, and in our sophomore year, there was one black, but by the senior year, it was half black. I asked him, so did you make any new friends? And there was a very long pause. And he said, you're making me think. And when I went back to give this talk in New Orleans at a bookstore like this. Mike Sheff was in the audience, which made me a little nervous, but and later a black woman who teaches African American studies at the University of New Orleans came forward. She asked the question about race, and I talked about it, and we she and I sort of got going after the talk, and Mike came up, and then she and Mike got going. And now they have plans to meet for coffee. That's what I want to come of this. It's not, you know, it's not that are they racist, aren't they? They're a mixture of things, but so are we. And there needs to be, we're on a journey, and it needs to continue. And we can't use this to divide us, I believe. Can't start with
I have to put in an advertisement here for the group I founded, actually, in D.C. and continue to be an editor at the Economic Hardship Reporting Project. When the right-wing militias took over that nature sanctuary in Oregon, Burns, Oregon, I got this brilliant idea.
I called, she gets a lot of those, by the way.
I got this great black writer. He lives in Portland, and he'd written a lot of things for us. He's very good. I said, why don't you go to Burns, Oregon, and cover this story? Just see what happens.
Mm-hmm.
Now, part of me felt really guilty, like I'll be responsible if anything bad happens to him. And the other part of me, I thought, you know, this is great, because he didn't go there like, who are you, what are you about, or something. He went there to say, you know, he wanted to hear their story, but to say that he had been in occupations too. You know, like Occupy and like all kinds of things. And to just engage people insofar as he could. And of course, I said, don't worry. They're all going to insist they're not racist. In fact, when he finally got into the refuge, and he just walked into it, or, you know, passed the perimeter, and they let him in. They ended up asking him to join their occupation. No, which he didn't. No. He's a good part of. I mean, his job didn't extend to that. But yeah, they were objectively racist. I'm sure with ties to all kinds of white supremacist groups. Through that Bundy operation, you know, the ranchers in the West, and yet, if you start, you know, having coffee, getting into these situations. Mm-hmm. Anyway, we can't do that. But you're going to answer the question now, I'm sure, of what we can do, and I'll turn it over to you to ask the questions. Yes, back there. Oh, you microphone.
Hi, thank you so much for coming out here. I'm an AU student, but I'm originally from Kentucky. Back home, I have a calculus teacher who's a proud Republican, Hunter, and member of the NRA. But I was having a conversation with him about the election, and he told me he simply could not vote for Trump. And why? He said that it was because of the possibility of setting such a negative tone in this country. And so my question to you is, why do people, good-hearted, smart people accept this sort of risk that Trump could have in this country, the negative tone?
Oh, more than that, too. Yeah. Wonderful question. I found the first time he came on the scene, people felt quite negative for a number of reasons. So as a kind of a magnetic draw to the Republican final, how are you going to vote? Many of them backed into the position of being ready to vote. But one woman, very sweet woman, I've dedicated the the book to she and her husband, said, "I can't vote for him. He's ridiculed, disabled. A disabled man was the, you know, where he imitates the man who's crippled." So she said, "No. What kind of moral person could do that?" Another said, "Well, I'm scared of him. You know, he could start a war. I don't want to put the nuclear code in the hand of such an erratic person." Another was turned off by his display of wealth. That wasn't a big appeal at all. But something has marshaled a good number of them. So initially, half of them didn't want to vote for Trump. But a number of those have turned around and are backing into it because they do not see an alternative. And they feel that the government is an instrument of marginalization, that this could go on for another 4 years, another four after that, and push them further back. And so it speaks to what they see as an alternative, I think.
Yeah, I mean, I think also he sort of changed his line as he found the white working class thing was working, you know, yes, for him. So he emphasized that, yes.
Hi. Hi. I want to echo what you have been saying about, sorry, this is making me nervous, about Louisiana and oil. I worked with the government and the environmental people and the state regulators and the oil industry to see if there were some solutions. I want to give you a sense of what an oil refinery is. If you can imagine a 40-story building that goes from this store all the way down to Military Road or further, across the street, all the way down there. Enormous. It's just enormous. And it is run by literally a handful of people who reside, who work from bunkers that are maybe the size of this store. Mm-hmm. So this is very small employee population and an enormous facility that's all pipes and they cover all kinds of things. They cover very, very toxic sludge and gases, and it's a huge, huge industry. And I can absolutely see what would have happened in Louisiana about the state government and the oil industry and the effect. Okay. Around the refineries are the communities of African Americans who can't live anywhere else, can't afford. I'd see children who had no hair walking around in their community in the vicinity of the refineries. The state regulators were not permitted to tell these families what was causing this illness in their children. They were not permitted. So it's hard.
Yeah.
Another story about Louisiana. I went down there for Katrina, and we were working very hard. We had a warehouse where we were bringing in lots of stuff for the communities there, and we were distributing food and clothes and so on. And it's very intense. But we're working really hard, and we're sweating, and we're living in the basement of a church and so on. And it took me a while to realize that there were no black people coming for that stuff. Because nobody would tell them. They didn't know that that stuff was there for them. And when finally they got the word, the people, not the Red Cross people, but the people we had to deal with in the community in order to provide, they started making rules about how many cans of vegetables you could get, about how many pieces of clothing you could get, about how many hours you could be there to collect this stuff. So it's just such an intense divide. The scary part about it is that it's the very ordinariness of it in that place.
Right.
Here we would be all, you know, crazy, mad, righteous, indignant, and so on. But there, it's just, it's ordinary.
Right. Right.
Do you want to frame a question?
Yes. Okay. So
you have us.
All gripped. So I appreciate what you have done.
Thank you.
With this enormous divide and the ordinariness of life in each place and the bitterness and resentment against the government, my question is, when Hillary is elected, which we're all pretty sure she's going to be elected.
We have to get out there, get out the vote, get out the vote. It's not in the bag.
How does she govern us? How can we be governable? Because I think these people are not.
Okay, let me take that. You know, thank you so much for a very moving description, hugely description. There is now a the main community of environmentalists. It's called LEAN, Louisiana Environmental Action Network, is a part of something called the Green Army. Now, this is not a lot of environmentalists, but it is led by the biracial Governor Russell Honoré, who was the rescuer in Katrina and most recently a rescuer again in the big flood. Much revered, biracial, and he actually is bringing together blacks and whites. He's done a lot of work in a place called St. Rose, where three generations of women, grandmother, mother, and daughter, are all on respirators because they're right next to an asphalt plant. Terrible things. But, and even this man, Mike Sheff, you know, he is writing letters on behalf of the residents of Mossville, which is a black community. So through the environment, he's reaching out to blacks in a way he never has before. So I see the environment as one of a number of potential crossover issues that can bring the races together in a quite natural way. They are common victims. So there are possibilities. Thank you.
I think it's this turn side.
Sure, yeah. I have a comment and a question. The comment is, thank you for illustrating the value of conversation. I'm an anthropologist, that's what we do. And it's so important to talk to people you're unfamiliar with, and especially to listen. And this is, you know, this is an assignment I will give to the audience in professor mode. Go have a conversation with someone you don't know and you disagree with, and listen to what they have to say. It's really, really interesting and fun, usually. Usually.
Yes.
My question is, I haven't read your book yet, so it's on my list. I'm curious about whether you do any regional or international comparisons. So one thing that sort of came to mind as I was walking over here was Kathy Kramer at the University of Wisconsin had a book out either earlier this year or last year called The Politics of Resentment, where she talked to rural voters in Wisconsin. And this is sort of coming out of the sort of big labor battles of 2011 in Wisconsin, sort of figuring out, like, you know, why is it that this message that public employees have it better than everybody else is resonating, you know, that they're the takers, right? Mm-hmm. And so, you know, and there's some, I think, some similarities there in terms of sort of this idea that other people are getting ahead while you're being left behind and that kind of thing. And then internationally, my research has been in Russia, and there's sort of, Russia's very different from the United States in a lot of ways, but there's some kind of, I think there's some sort of, yep. I don't know.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Great. Thank you for that comment. I'm not familiar with that book, but I do refer to other scholars who have found this deep story kind of resonant for the people they have come to know and write about. But I am very mindful of what the turn to the right in Europe, in France, in Germany, in England, with Brexit,
Hungary.
In Russia, sorry?
Hungary.
And Hungary. Recently, my husband and I went to Budapest to give some lectures, and Hungary is a country that has really elected a fascist leader. The free press is pretty much muzzled now. Civic organizations, nonprofits, are there are new licenses that make it hard for them to continue. The statues have now changed. There used to be a variety of kinds of statues. Now they are all Hungarian, and the heroic past of the Hungarians, which wipes out any memory of Hungary's role in the extermination of the Jews in Budapest, for example. That memory has been wiped out. So I asked a man, how could this happen? Hungary didn't used to be like that. How could it possibly happen? I mean, they were embracing democracy and a vital civic life. And the answer I got was, the left was very divided and inward turned.
You mean we can't keep on having fights and internally?
Well,
it's so fun.
Well, yeah, but I think there is a lesson for us this very day.
You know, we've officially exhausted our time in this formation, so I'm going to say we could have two more questions. Does that sound right to you?
What we can do is have them ask the questions quickly, the two questions, and then you can answer.
Right. Let's take four questions that you'll have to memorize, Arlie, because then you're going to have to answer them all correctly.
Four.
And let's make them quick.
Well, I don't know if this will be quick or not, but I'd like to tack in a little different direction. And I've had some experience in the South back in the 70s, and I found you have some very smart people there, much to, I think, to the misconception of a lot of Northerners. But you mentioned the reaction to Rush Limbaugh, and I'd like to ask, to what extent did conversations ever involve their resentment as to their plight and their current existence due to the deviation from their thinking that maybe we ought to be more grounded in constitutional practices and policies, constitutionally conservative practices and policies, because for all intents and purposes, you have both industrial oligarchs and political oligarchs in that part of the country. The history is replete. So my question is, to what extent did your discussions ever involve with the issues of practice and principles of constitutional conservatism?
Yeah, I don't know.
It was there.
Oh, no, we're going to you have to have to memorize the question.
All right.
And then you're going to answer four once.
This is getting hard.
So
okay.
You know, a quick okay. He's pulling the strings here. I'm just totally upfront.
Yeah. Want me to ask it? Yeah, well, I'm from Arkansas, so just right north of Louisiana. And, you know, nothing you wrote was, you know, surprising to me. I thought it was an excellent book so far. Things you call paradoxes, we would call just the mind-blowingly screwed up stuff that goes on in the South. And my question, though, is, you know, it's very great that you're getting out and going with a non-judgmental way to ask these questions. But, you know, if we're going to aim for greater understanding, my question is, did anyone ever ask you the other way, what do you think and why?
Surprisingly little.
I can believe that, yeah.
They know, because they think you're of the class that rules, you know, this country.
Just say one last thing. I mean, I think they have a chip on their shoulder and a deep-seated inferiority complex that they're not thinking about you. So the dialogue isn't both ways.
Yeah. Right.
Okay, plus, let me just one more question, and then she will answer everything.
Remember. Sorry, hi.
Constitution, Arkansas.
Can I use a pencil?
Hi, I'm a student at Georgetown. I just want to thank you for being here. A question about where the future of this deep story. It seems you talked about how this is a story that's so contingent on American history, events that have happened, the Civil War, the Civil Rights Movement, the rise of cultural environmentalism. I'm wondering first, is this election seems to have brought out a lot of the issues that you're talking about. I mean, we're having a conversation here and maybe nationally about some of these concerns and about some of these people that hold these beliefs and those that don't also. Is this election going to be another one of those inflection points that deepens the deep story? Or is it going to be combative? Like, is this a story you have an appendix in the book where you lay out sort of facts, right, that are alternate and disagree with this deep story? So is this an election that can sort of factually combat that? Or is this a deep story that sort of just has to die out over time because it seems so deeply flawed? And will this election, do you think, be a part of that, either a nail in the coffin or something that just sort of ratchets up and intensifies, becomes another brick in the wall of that deep story?
Wow. Okay. So just Constitution, like yes, Arkansas.
No,
question.
Okay.
Yeah. So,
oh, yeah. Okay, yeah. First one was the Constitution with people.
They did talk about it, but, you know, emotionally understood, I came to have a different feeling about the talk of constitutions and Bibles and flags. There were certain things that the people I talked to from the other side of the empathy bank, I thought they were being hyper-symbolized. They were so important. They stood as representing what was solid. And I came to understand that in light of many parts of their personal lives that were not solid. The families in this state were much more disrupted. There was more alcoholism, more fathers who just went out the door and did not return. Something solid at home dissolved and became unsolid. So it's in that light that I came to understand the need for a constitution, the need for a Bible, the need for a flag that represented stability. Stability was scarce. So that's that.
It's interesting, yeah.
And Arkansas. Your question was.
It's actually, did they ever care to know what you thought and ask you?
Partly it's a different ethic. I think the social classes, and there was a class, I think, difference between me and most of the people I talked to. And I think my ethic, I'm used to asking questions and sort of getting summary information right away. Well, you know, what did your father do? Where did you go to college? Blah, blah. What are these are kind of like pinpointy questions that I'm unembarrassed to ask, which I did not do in this way. I mean, I just kind of became a sponge. But they are more mannerly, and they wait for things to emerge. And then very softly will kind of make a conclusion. Like one person said, well, you're a people pleaser. Mm-hmm. Oh, well, my goodness, that one's looking at me all right. You know? So, you know, that was interesting that I did feel looked at, but not examined in some aggressive or assertive even way. That's okay. What?
Well,
I think they observed me correctly, but not in the form of questions. They have their own way of coming, of concluding who you are, you know?
Well, yes. I mean, we're talking about a major intellectual here, world-renowned intellectual, mm-hmm. who is always, in conversation.
Yeah.
You know, right. That's what we do.
Right.
We're world-class internet. that seems rude to some people in the
That's
country.
Right. That's
go up
right.
and say, well, what's your politics, huh?
Yeah.
You know. So, anyway, do you remember the last question?
No. I flunked. Oh, yes. Hello. Right. Yes.
Oh, no. Yeah. Okay. Is it election?
It will. I think that the main concern for these people is being, in a way, addressed most directly, of course, by Donald Trump. But other, of course, leaders could more and differently and more effectively deal with their distress. And they don't see an alternative to Trump. So I see it as probably it's going to be just a battle that ignores the deep story. It ignores their deep story and our, if I may say so, deep story, which has to do with a kind of standing around a public square in the center of which is a state-of-the-art children's science museum that we're just so proud, you know, we could tweak our whiskers. That's the best museum. And then these fabulous schools, public schools, and libraries open day and night, and museums. We love that available to all, integrative, and of society. And we feel like we've built this, or we value it, our tax money, we don't begrudge it to keep it up. And then we see some marauders coming in and gouging out huge chunks of concrete in that very museum and going behind our backs and building a big mansion, something private, not available to everybody. And that's deeply offensive to us. And so I think that is our deep story, and that it does block out some truths as theirs. I wouldn't give it equivalence. And that's our distress. Oh, okay. Certainly, that's the distress that originally led me to begin this.
Okay, I'm getting signals from on high saying that we have to now get our book signed. So let's thank our...
Live at Politics and Prose is a co-production of The Bookstore and Slate.com. For information about upcoming Politics and Prose events, visit politics-prose.com. And please let us know what you think of this program. Our email is podcasts@slate.com.